Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I'm the artist formerly known as Frank Thompson. I'll be your genial host for this episode. And it's a good one, I think, as you can hear from the switch out in our theme music. We have a very special guest tonight, the composer of that music that you just heard, which is the theme from Kevin Brownlow's Hollywood series, Mr. Carl Davis. I met with Mr. Davis in San Francisco when we were up there a few months ago to see Napoleon, Kevin Brownlow's incredible restoration of Abel Gance's film. And of course, Carl Davis wrote and conducted the score, and it was a magnificent event. This actually took place the day before, and I'll tell you a little story that will illuminate something that happens about midway through the interview. It turns out that Carl Davis and I were staying in the same hotel, and I thought that would make things very simple for doing an interview. This is not an incredibly complicated setup, but it does take a little bit of time to set up the two microphones and microphone stands and get the recorder all set up. And so I thought, this is perfect. I'll just have him come to my room and everything will be all set up. And he's an important man and he doesn't have to sit around and watch me unroll cords and plug things in and so forth. So I had everything set up in my room, and suddenly in the next room, I started hearing blood-curdling screams, and furniture sounded like it was being thrown about, and it sounded like bathroom fixtures were being ripped from the walls and thrown through jagged windows, and it sounded like a mob hit was happening next door, except either the killer or the victims seemed to be 40 to 50 women with screams. One thing that made me think they possibly weren't being murdered was that their screams were mixed with maniacal laughter. So I thought perhaps they were the killers. A little bit of checking into this, and it turns out that a Mary Kay convention had come into the hotel that very day, and that, I don't know, somewhere between 200 and 200 Mary Kay sales ladies were in the room right next to me, and they were acting as if it were Armageddon for Mary Kay ladies, and I think even Dario Argento would quail at the sound of the screaming and horrible laughter that was coming from next door. So I realized it would be futile for me to go next door and implore them to shut up because I was about to do an interview with Carl Davis. And I, between you and me and the gatepost, I felt that if I did go over there, I would not be coming back alive. So I ran down to the lobby, went to the manager and told him the situation in a nutshell and said that it was pretty much his responsibility after subjecting me to this that he would find me a quiet place to do an interview. Turns out there was a little boardroom right off the lobby that was going to be empty for the afternoon, and so I ran up and got all my equipment, brought it down, set it up on this conference table, and all was swell. So Mr. Davis came down, fresh from a nap, and I'd say a little grumpy at the beginning. I felt like it took a while for him to recognize my innate likability, but I think I finally won him over. But he did come in, having just awakened from a nap and ready to talk about music. And about midway through the conversation, I heard those same screams and maniacal laughter right outside the conference room door. And so when you hear us stop and with a little bit of quaver in our voices, discuss how we've been found and that they're right outside the door, you'll know what it is. Luckily, I had hung garlic on the door and a crucifix, and so they were unable to enter. And as everybody knows, a Mary Kay sales lady cannot come into your house unless she's specifically invited. But that's the only way she's on like a vampire, or like a vampire, because if you put one in front of a mirror, she can't stop looking into it. So it's quite a different situation. And so it's a tiny moment in the interview, but but there you go. The other different thing that I'm going to do in tonight's episode is that I'm playing excerpts from Carl Davis's music when things come up. I thought that would be a fun thing to do. They're very brief, and obviously you can purchase all the music that you hear if you go to Amazon and click on the links through the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and I'll rail on this a little bit more after the interview, but I have a lot of Carl Davis's music in my own personal library, and I think all right-thinking people everywhere should do the same. He's really a remarkable composer. He's pretty much transformed the way we think of silent film music. It's hard to think of what the situation in watching silent films was like before 1980 and his orchestral versions. Of course, during the silent era, you could have heard a lot of different kinds of music in theaters, from single pianos all the way up to major orchestras for special venues. But as we talked a little bit about in this interview, when I first started seeing silent films on TV, they were presented in a very unflattering light, and usually with tinny piano, and shown at the wrong speed, and shown in very dupey-looking prints, and mostly as objects of derision and not as works of art. And I will correct something that you haven't even heard me say yet, but I talked to Mr. Davis about how I believe that his was the first time, when I heard the Hollywood series, that it was the first time I'd ever really heard silent films being treated with musical respect. And that's not really true. I would go back a few years to Paul Killiam's great series that was on PBS called The Silent Years. And while those were normally more modest scores, they were wonderful scores and evocative, and they did treat the films with respect, with people like William Perry and Lee Irwin and other great musicians who really did some wonderful things. So I felt like I gave them kind of a short shrift when I said that to Mr. Davis. So when you hear me talk about that, although I think the point is still kind of valid, remember that I do know my history a little bit better than that. I was just under the spell. What can I say? So I hope you will enjoy this interview. It was great fun for me to finally meet him and talk with him. It was the day before I saw Napoleon. And so if it had been that very day, I probably would have been so overcome with emotion that I wouldn't have been able to talk about anything. And I'll also, last but not least, will mention that I begin the interview with a subject that isn't really related to film at all, and I hope that you will bear with me. But I ask him about working on Liverpool Oratorio with Paul McCartney, and as I explained to him, obviously my love for the Beatles is boundless, but also Liverpool Oratorio featured a great friend of mine, Jerry Hadley, who is a wonderful tenor and who left us, I guess, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. And I miss him still, and it's always a pleasure to talk with anyone who worked with him and who knew him and liked him. And I think everybody who knew him liked him. So we spend the first few minutes just talking about Liverpool Oratorio, Paul McCartney, and my friend Jerry Hadley. And then we get on to Hollywood and Napoleon and all the various scores that Carl Davis has written. And it's nothing but fun for me. So please enjoy this episode of The Commentary Track with my guest, Carl Davis. First, a non-film question, because this project that you worked on has two very personal connections with me, which is Liverpool Oratorio. For one thing, the Beatles had more of an impact on my life than almost any other single thing I can think of. And for another thing, my friend Jerry Hadley was the lead tenor in that. He was a very dear friend of mine, and just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, the Liverpool Oratorio arose as a pièce d'occasion. It was a piece written for an occasion. The occasion was the 150th anniversary of the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, which was celebrated in 1991. It's probably the oldest orchestra in England still in existence. And I had a very strong relationship with the orchestra and did a lot of concerts with them of film music. We did actual silent films with them. Premiered a version of The Gold Rush, which was to the adapting Chaplin's music to the 1925 cut of it, which is very rare to see. They asked me in about, I'd say, the end of 1988. They explained to me that they were going to celebrate this anniversary, and did I have any ideas? They would want to be involved, wanted me to be involved in some way or another. And I, for various reasons, said, "What about something with McCartney?" That was the phrase I used to the then concerts manager then. And they said, "Oh, what a great idea, you know." And I said, "Well, now the problem with getting to him, that he's, lives behind quite a barrier of protection and exclusivity." But I was lucky enough to find a way, and we wrote this piece, which was performed in June of 1991.
Yes. I wrote the I saw a making of special.
That's
about
right.
That, and I still don't quite understand how the collaboration worked. Did he give you musical themes and you developed them, or was it that simple?
Oh,
is it more of a give and take?
Initially, I thought that's kind of was what was going to happen, but then in the end, as we kind of felt our way towards what the piece eventually became, it became apparent that it really was going to work better if we actually did it together, and that I did very little work on it on my own. We really did write it together.
What's your memory of Jerry?
Jerry was had just sort of emerged at the time. What happened is that the work itself, once it was clear what it was going to be, and that it was going to be a fully orchestral work with choir, with children, and with a quartet of soloists, and a soprano, alto, tenor, bass thing, so it was a kind of mini Beethoven 9, plus children, getting very complex, and it needed to be cast, basically. I mean, I might have had one or two ideas, but they brought in somebody from an agency to actually help us find the soloists, and Jerry was suggested. He had recently kind of really had a career move with a recording of Showboat. It was the year that happened, and we got to have the joy of listening to the original arrangements and so on. What was his name? John McGill, I think. Was the name. Terrific guy who had done all this excavation and so on. And Jerry had sung Gaylord Ravenel, mm-hmm, in Showboat, and I thought he was a very good singer. And anyway, he was suggested. He was so enthusiastic that he literally flew New York, London, simply to meet us, and flew right back again. Literally arrived in the morning, came down to Paul's studio, and flew back again that night, you know, because he was so keen. And we all thought, well, it sort of counted for a lot, actually. I mean, that he did this. And we showed him the sketches of how far we had gone at that point. And in fact, I think we had more or less had a complete rehearsal score, so it wasn't reading manuscript. And he was just very, very enthusiastic, and we thought he was just a terrific singer and marvelous to work with. And he was sort of my buddy. He did a lot of the shows after the premiere as well. It had quite a, it was picked up in various places around the world, and that was nice. And then I was able to use him outside that context. When I remember doing a Faschings concert with him in Munich, and he was very keen on Lehar, and so we dug around some things with that. So he was really just my friend in music. You know, it was very, very nice to have him with me. And yeah, he was always my first choice for the oratorio. Though I didn't always get him, you know, but and other people did it, but none as well as he did.
He always talked about what an incredible experience it was for him. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think the first time we ever met in person, that was the first thing he brought up and regaled me with tales.
Well, like yourself, I mean, he was a Beatles fan, so you know, here you were with, you know, Paul, And it was good, and the character was so very much based on Paul initially in his initial phases, or the first three or four movements. He just was very, very good.
But I can say that looking back, the most important thing I found was sagging off. Not for the whole world, but for yourself were you born, and you were born in Liverpool. Being born where you were born carries with it certain responsibilities.
We'll get on to the more appropriate subject for this podcast, which is about film. I guess let's start at the beginning with the first time you ever wrote anything for silent film would be for Kevin and David Gill in the Hollywood series, right?
That's correct.
And when you got that job, was it a form of composition that was at all foreign to you, or did you take to it immediately? What kind of study did you have to do to adapt to that kind of musical composition?
The relationship started with a series called Hollywood, which was presented by or produced by a commercial channel in England called Thames Television. Thames Television had a very strong line in documentary film, and in particular it had a huge success with a series called The World at War, which was released in the early 1970s and which I did the music for. There was one presiding genius over this whole affair, which was a man called Jeremy Isaacs, who was the head of documentaries for Thames Television. So he had produced The World at War, and they had rewarded the success of that, rewarded him with giving him control of programs over it all. So his role extended. And around that time, he discovered this book of Kevin Brownlow's called The Parade's Gone By, which we all regard as a kind of Bible.
Yes.
The success of World War meant also that Jeremy was able to go on with his plans to actually do a documentary based on The Parade's Gone By, and because of the World War, put me together as part of the team of a producer called David Gill and Kevin and myself, kind of a triumvirate on the series. And in working on the series, First of all, Silent Film was not a stranger to me. In that, you know, it was something I was already interested in, but to the degree that one can be interested, in what way? You know, in other words, I wasn't someone who was actually playing for Silent Film, because in those days, we're talking now the 70s, you know, except for the National Film Theatre, the NFT on the South Bank in London, you know, you just had a pianist played. So in a way, our view of it was, you know, that way, somebody played the piano and improvised. Working on the Hollywood series meant that I had to actually make a fuller study and discovered that if you went to the cinema in its heyday or at any point in its history, you would have actually heard more than just a piano. And in its most ambitious kind of presentation, you would have had a full orchestra. So it was really that's where I came in, and that's when it became very interesting to me. That there was this sort of other world, you know, relating to it, which had to do with the musicians, the orchestra, the musical director, the repertoire, the theaters that were built for it or adapted for it. And in doing so, I was able to meet a number of musicians, because there was a research element and budget. At the time, to come out to the West Coast and meet someone like Gaylord Carter or Anne Leaf was still alive and playing, and you know, really talked to them about things like, you know, how do you put together a score? How do you stay in sync? How do you how do you work it out, and so on? So that was very good, and they were actually interviewed in the Hollywood series as well. And so I got to know a lot about it, and in particular, particularly in the context of something like Napoleon, the idea that, you know, you couldn't actually sit down and write an entirely original score without a lot of time, and they didn't have a lot of time. So they relied on a mixture of, you know, a library, or writing something especially for it. Europe, it was where there was a more active role of a publisher actually publishing a score, particularly if the composer was, you know, distinguished in some way. A more concert, less, you know, of cinema as an art form. So there's more music available that is still around that mm-hmm. you could find. But I just had a feeling for it. I mean, Kevin always complimented me with that and said, well, you've got a natural feeling for doing this. And I think one aspect of it is that, you know, I grew up in musical theater. I grew up in opera and ballet and, liking and performing and playing music, that where the music had a very integral role in the in its actual life. So an opera, can you imagine an opera without an orchestra score, or a ballet without an orchestra score? And I brought all of my interest. I think Mary Kay is
I think they found us.
Yes.
There's no escape.
All right, so we let
yes,
it go.
Yes, we'll just let it go. There's nothing we can do about it at this point.
That in an opera or in a ballet, it's inconceivable that you would not have an orchestra in it, and that would be an integral part of it. It gave it its life, really. And it seemed to me that in the Silent Film, we were looking for an orchestral accompaniment that was as full, as participating, as full of information about what was going on in the film, to support elements which, you know, kind of replaced the dialogue, replaced the spoken dialogue. It was going to have to tell the audience a lot about what was going on, not only physically, you know, a storm, you know, a landscape, a fight, whatever, but also what was a kind of emotional underpinning of it, or sometimes historical underpinning of it as well. So I kind of liked that. I really did enjoy that kind of composition. In fact, it's really tough when I have to do a contemporary film because in that context, I tend to overwrite because they'd say, well, you know, leave something for the actors to do. whereas in silent film, that's exactly what's needed.
Yes.
An operatic score.
I believe the Hollywood series represented the first time to me that I ever heard music taking the film seriously and treating them like art and respecting the art. Mm. And I'm assuming that was just your instinct, if not your mandate, to do that, right?
Well, I think it's what I brought to it, because that's me. All these things are very subjective. And because in a way, we can do what we like because there's no commercial weight behind it. Mm-hmm. It's a collector's item, no matter how you approach it. But let's put it this way: I would say very proudly, we've taken things to the point where, as you might play optimistically in a school situation, in a club situation, in a special viewing, you know, with very small, a few people coming and so on, to a situation where we're playing, able to perform Napoleon to an audience of 3,000 people a night here in Oakland. But on the other hand, you know, we did that at the Radio City Music Hall in New York with that, or something like the Royal Festival Hall in London. We regularly sell out a 2,800 seat concert hall. And I think before the Hollywood series and the subsequent work we did from 1980 on, which is from Napoleon on, that we've recreated it in a perhaps almost ideal form, because it can be rehearsed. It's approached, each film is approached as a unique element. We're there to see that film. And so there's no formula you would go by. Whereas if we were in a situation, as they were, where there was a regular turnaround, if a film didn't work, you'd immediately replace it with another one or revive something or something. So that, taking the consideration of the uniqueness of the film was less in order of some music, any kind of music to make it work. So it's different than it was, when that was what cinema is. We're sort of saying we're more like, an opera company, which would present operas from the 17th to the 20th century, if not the 21st century, with a particular emphasis on the 19th century. So when you see something like a Mozart opera with recitative and things like that, you accept that convention because you're going to have this gorgeous Mozart playing, and it's the same way here. You know, each one is unique, and it belongs to its time, belongs to its period, and we respect that. We respect that. Yeah. What I don't do is try to use the film as a background to an avant-garde score. You know, it sort of tipped the other way,
yes.
where the predominant interest is actually in the music or in the display, which sometimes can be in direct competition to the film, if not dominate it. Our approach is really different. We're sort of saying this is a really exciting film, worth seeing, and the score, from my point of view, if you came to me to do it, would be one that does respect it and sort of say it's that kind of film, it's in that period, its subject is X, whatever it is, and we go with that. We try and support that.
Yeah, too many times I've seen films that seem to be backdrops to a concert.
Exactly.
And it's disturbing.
Mm.
One thing that's always interested me when I hear your subsequent scores after the Hollywood series is how many themes showed up in the Hollywood series that later showed up in the scores, and it's almost as though you were planning for the scores, or was it simply that the one that I just most recently saw, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, that wonderful little like a sad tango theme for Valentino is in the Hollywood series years before you did it for Four Horsemen. Is that just because when you did Four Horsemen, you thought, well, I've got this nice Valentino theme, or were you thinking ahead to something else?
I think we had no idea what was actually going to happen on November 30th, 1918, how that was really going to change our history, our individual history. The Hollywood series was made without thought to that what would happen after the Hollywood series, so that my compositions, like, say, the Valentino Tango, was composed for an episode which had a biography, which was a biography of, I think he shared it with the hour with Gloria Swanson. So there was a half hour of Gloria Swanson and half an hour of Valentino. Not that he didn't crop up in other parts of the story, but they tried to do an episode which focused on individuals as opposed to films. So I wrote this tango as the main theme for this episode, because he had made his mark in film was in Four Horsemen dancing the tango. So it became his theme. Then in November 30th, 1980, was the premiere of our version of Napoleon, where we performed as much material as Kevin had. And the circumstances of it, which is another whole discussion, the performance made a terrific impact. And in particular, this one person, Jeremy Isaacs, who the producer of The World at War and then started to be the producer of the Hollywood series, left halfway through the production or to change his position. But at that point in 1980... was putting together a new television channel called Channel 4 in England. It seems amazing today, but in England, even by 1980, they had only three channels. and this was the fourth, so that was a sensation, with the brief of being different from the other three, and being unusual and so on. And the effect of that Hollywood, of that screening of Napoleon with orchestra, with me, was for him to say, it made such an impression. He said, I will commission a series of reconstructions. I never can remember the word exactly. Restorations of films with scores by Carl Davis, a very specific commitment to me. In the project, and they were at a particular rate. I'd say the five years of 80 to 85 that he was in charge of the project, we actually did three a year, of which Four Horsemen was one. And then he went on to other things. His contract ran out, and other people took up the job. And until the chief executives respected this, they didn't produce them at such a rate. It went to really one a year, but that relationship ran until 2000. So that was a kind of 20-year run in which one or two or three films sometimes a year were made, mostly with scores by me. And the effect of that was to create a repertoire. I now can say, I've over 60 films that I do, either commissioned as part of that package or by the Chaplin Estate or related to the Chaplin Estate or something because I wanted to do it. There are various strands in it, in the repertoire. But it didn't exist before. So all this is by way of saying, when we did the Hollywood series, and which was a sort of from about 76 when he sort of started doing the research till its first broadcast, which was in January 80. I had actually no idea. I said, well, that was a self-enclosed job. You know, there were some specials that happened across this period, so that we did a series called Unknown Chaplain, a series on Harold Lloyd, a series on the life of Buster Keaton. But the concept of actually having a career composing and conducting silent films would not have occurred to any of us in 1980, when we did the first one, Napoleon, it was something that was evolved. Of course, if we got to, say, a film like The Crowd, which was the second one we did, we had actually covered, because we all, three of us, loved the film, we had actually shown some massive clips from it as part of the Hollywood series. So I felt, well, in some ways, there's no reason on earth why I shouldn't use them. They were all, you know, created for the same team and so on. So that and that became a practice. If it turned out that I had already done something successfully, Ben-Hur, and there were themes that I had already composed, I tended to start there, you know, and say, what have I got that we like that seemed to, you know, have some very strong relation to the film, and go on from there. So the answer is yes, but not premeditated. And certainly with not a thought that, I mean, it was so extraordinary that by the mid-80s, I remember performing a film called The Wind at a festival of television versions of silent film in Frankfurt, and there were, you know, over 40 entries, you know, from different countries and so on. So it immediately seemed to wake up something, you know, wake up a kind of public interest in doing it and doing it live.
Well, that's the interesting thing about it to me, is that it's almost the only thing in cinema today that seems to require a live performance. That, although it's nice to watch them on television and a nice Blu-ray or DVD or so forth, there's no comparison to seeing it in a theater with the orchestra and with the screen, the full size and everything. It's almost like opera, which also you can watch on TV if you choose
to. Now you watch in a cinema.
Exactly.
As a kind of high-definition event, thanks to Peter Gelb.
Yeah, but the experience of an opera is really only at maximum effectiveness when you're seeing it live.
Of course.
And
of course.
These performances of Napoleon, people keep asking me, well, are they going to put it on DVD? And I say, well, they who knows? But I wouldn't want to see it that way. I want to see it this way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what we're presenting in here in Oakland is actually the ideal. This is what it should be like. Even to the size of the massive stage, so we could actually present the triptych where the film actually is three times larger.
Yes.
You know, the screen is three times larger than the single screen. And you do need a very wide stage and a large venue to do this.
Yeah.
I've done it in a variety of settings, and we've always had a large screen for the end. We now feel it's worth fighting for, and that you've spent your 5 hours waiting for this to happen, and you shouldn't disappoint the audience in it not being like that. But of course, you know, you take into account expense and so on. So I have a feeling that Napoleon is not going to be a repertory piece, that it will always be a festival piece, or a piece in which you say, well, we're going to spend on it, you know, because you won't get that incredible thrill and bizarreness of seeing the triple screen. So even now, people are contacting me and said, oh, we've got this darling little theater that seats 100, or seats 800, we even 800. And you said, well, it won't be big enough, you know, to take your normal Academy, unless you had, you know, it is for three screens. It has to be three times larger. And we're holding to that. I respect that. You know. So I think there is, that almost immediately Images had made a 70 mil of it, so you didn't have to have three projectors.
Yes.
But we've improved our standard over the years of how this should look. And it's worth fighting for because it is amazing.
I agree.
And it's also the film's calling card.
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't be so interested in it if it weren't. Not that I'd say that's its only virtue, but it certainly... it is so thrilling when it happens and so kind of crazy that people, you know, it's just worth fighting for.
Sure. The version that Kevin has finally restored it to today is different from what you originally played for in some respects in 1980, right? I mean, it's the length is somewhat longer and it's... did you have to do any adaptation of your score to any significant extent?
Continuously. Mm. I'm still doing it.
Ah.
The version that we're screening here in Oakland was created in 2000. So it had already there already was a 20-year period between 1980 and 2000, and then it kind of revived in 2001, revived in 2004, and each time it sort of changed even then a little bit. And with this, if you say something like, oh, we're going to remake the title cards, and they'll be dyed, you know, they'll be tinted as well, etc., you still find a variation in the speed, in the footage of it. It isn't that they sort of said, this went on for 10 feet, and so you will have 10 feet forward again. It's sort of always in variation. It's not, I have to put that at the feet of my colleagues, they're not strictly on my side in that thing, because every time you do alter film, you'll then alter its timing. And so the music to keep up the synchronization will be different and it would have to be adapted. But that almost started immediately. For instance, when we first started doing Napoleon, we couldn't work out how to run the triptych at 20 frames. So it always suddenly jumped to 24 frames. Perhaps we should explain to your public that that one of the issues raised in Hollywood was the projection speed, that my colleagues felt that in the main silent film is projected too fast. And at the time when people did make these films, they were hand cranking the cameras, and you had options of how fast or slow you went. A director like Griffith, who was, after making Intolerance, was always broke, he tended to crank slowly to save footage.
Mm-hmm.
So this is always an issue, and it's completely subjective. And the discussion is always, what does it look like if you screen it at 16, 18, 20, 21, 25 for
yes.
Buster Keaton's The General? You know, that so that, and that, of course, affects me deeply because, you know, music and film go together because they can be measured. And if the film is going faster, you need to, you know, write less music than you would if the film is going slower because it takes more time. In a way, I've become extremely sensitive to speeds because they do affect my getting through the score, they do affect what I've written it for. The nuance of somebody simply crossing the room is different if it's slower, if it's faster, and I've written something to accommodate that. So the first move was, I suppose, the moment when they discovered that they could lock the triptych and show that at 20 frames, which then required more music because there was more
sure.
film,
yeah.
film, t- film on screen time. So there was that. Then, in terms of the history of the film, a historical event is when the film was, this version was finally screened in France. And when that happened, when Kevin was allowed to properly research the film at the Cinémathèque in Paris, reluctantly, and, you know, issues of patriotism come in to anything French. You know, he found more footage, and not only did he find more footage, but he found, which was highly significant, a document of Abel Gance in which he wrote down the historical sequence of sections of scenes. So he discovered that, in fact, we were not, in his version, that far. Was not observing historical order of the events. So in 83, a lot of things got swapped around, which of course meant the music had to be swapped around. But there also was a lot more new material. So the whole thing gained about 10 to 12 minutes at that point, but with this serious change in itself. So the score then had to be kind of remade again. More material followed in 2000, and then it's been sort of static that way. But then you had this sort of remaking title cards, tinting the thing, which didn't have an immediate effect on time, but it meant sort of you were still manipulating the print around, and it changed, you know. And so so it's in constant evolution. And I think one of the problems inherent in Napoleon is that Gance never finished it. If you sort of say, okay, we're going to do The General or Buster Keaton, you know, that's a finished film. You know, that's as left as Keaton left it. And so composing a score doesn't bring in those issues, that it's going to be constantly fluid, because nobody really knows. The version that we're doing is certainly not one that Gance would recognize, really, except he might have remembered the material, but it's actually Kevin's thoughts on what he thought Gance might have wanted.
And it's still always a film in flux, isn't it? I mean, if 20 more minutes shows up, then...
Well,
it changes
had
again.
More, we had 10 more seconds. We were going to premiere here, you see, in the schoolroom scene near the beginning and so on, and I was fully expecting it to happen, but it didn't. They decided they wouldn't disturb the print any further. It would mean splicing it in and so on, and that immediately has certain implications.
Well, the score must be gargantuan now. It must be Wagnerian.
It's virtually unliftable at the moment. I mean, in 2000 also, I took the chance to put it all on computer, so I wasn't lugging around, you know, mountains of manuscript. So it's smaller than it was, but it still occupies a large suitcase. And we do it in four acts, so it's in it's in six volumes, because acts one and acts three are so long that you can't, you know, we just bound it into two volumes. It's quite massive. It's sort of, if you would think of, you know, Wagner, if you think of Goethe Dämmerung or Meistersinger and so on, that's about an equivalent time.
Sure.
And Tristan. So there, it's all in that concept.
Do you have the number of orchestral members in mind when you write for something like this? I mean, is there an ideal orchestra for this?
I did initially. I don't so much now, because if I'm preparing a new score, I might. I mean, it's very useful for any composer and anywhere to know who's going to play it and what characteristics they have, and if there is someone who you know, is particularly strong in one area, you might want to you know, exploit that.
Sure.
You know? But in the initial version, I had some friends who were very interested were clarinetists and were very interested in all the different kinds of clarinets you can have in that period of the late 18th century. So the first period of Napoleon was a sort of kind of orgy of clarinets in C and in D and basset horn, which is still there. We're actually doing a lot of these things here. For some reason, I hit on a pocket of clarinet versatility. So so a lot of the original things are being the original versions of things are being played here.
Wonderful. Yeah, there are many. I mean, this is obviously a film that calls for a big sound. And other films might not. I mean, the Kid Brother or something like that might.
Well,
call
comedies,
for more intimate,
comedies tend to suffer if it's too big.
Yeah,
you know, they want a lighter texture, so they tend to be. So except something like Chaplin's, the restorations and live version of something like Modern Times or The Gold Rush, which of course were created much later and rent for a studio orchestra. Mm. So those are very ambitious and have quite large orchestras, but. In a sense, the size of the Napoleon Orchestra was very much dictated by the period. We were going to incorporate a lot of music of Napoleon's own period. So who were they? Okay, that's Beethoven, Haydn, and Mozart. Well, they did not write for enormous orchestras. So I started in my concept to say, well, what would be a typical Beethoven orchestra, and then say, well, would that be quite enough when we start getting things on a grander scale? So that slightly enlarged. I mean, it was very rare if he ever did use four horns. I think not till the Ninth Symphony, but we do, because beyond using the Haydn, Beethoven, Mozart, and other people from his period, who were sort of the second top. Rank, but second class, so to speak. It's fun kind of doing that. That there was still, it was still a film not made in 1800, but made in the 1920s, and so some of the shooting and the ideas underlying the film called for a much more romantic sound, fuller sound, and are not especially 18th century in tone at all.
I've never heard any of the Honegger score that was, I guess, written for one of the first versions of this. Have you heard it? Is it?
I incorporate. What happened was initially we all thought it was lost. The actual score that was used for the first performance vanished. No one knows what happened to it. But one of the French publishers did do a selection of seven excerpts from it that Honecker and himself worked on, so there are these seven pieces of which. But I didn't get to it until I was sort of in my third hour of it, and by which time I had established that we were going to have this broad portrait of Napoleon's own period. So, but there was one that attracted me very much, which was an arrangement of a patriotic hymn, which was written specifically for this campaign that ends, which is the Italian campaign, which ends the film. And it's called Le Chant du Départ, and it's sung today. It's sung by the Guard, played by the Guard Republican, and it became not the Star Spangled Banner, which would be the Marseillaise, but an extremely popular and well often sung patriotic song. And so what he did, what Honegger did, was he knowing this historically, did an arrangement of it. Also, very cleverly incorporating the Marseillaise in counterpoint to it, and so I thought, well, as an homage to the whole project, we incorporated it. When the armies march into Italy, we play that. amplified slightly because the triptych all has one very special instrument added to it, which is of a symphonic organ. It's very, very funny. When I first was composing the score, I worked with video then, which is after all 1980, and they only gave me the central screen of the triptych as a guide. For me to work with. And when we got to the first performance and we had only looked at the triptych with orchestra the day before, it was the first time I saw the effect of what it was like with the outer panels. And I suddenly thought, well, what I have just goes on the same. It doesn't acknowledge the fact that it's all gotten three times bigger. So in subsequent performances in 1981, I added an organ at that point, not earlier, just at that point, when the screens open up. So that is then added to the Honegger at the climactic moment of the Marseillaise coming in.
After starting out with Napoleon in 1980, the rest of the scores you wrote must have seemed like a piece of cake. This is it just seems like such
in
a
length,
massive
in length. yes, shorter, but certainly not in ambition.
Yes,
and I think I remember being very emphatic that that once Jeremy Isaacs' commission was in place and it was clear we would begin in 81. That I said, please do a film. Let's do a film which is not a heroic film and not a period film, something jazz based, or you know, and that we chose The Crowd as the second film. And I think the brief from Jeremy and the thing was to actually show the range, you know, that we would actually have the comedies, the western, the romances, the historical epics, one offs like Greed. You know, that have no duplication anywhere else. Adventure stories, etc. That we were able to just as you would in an opera house. You know, present a full representation of all the styles.
I saw you conduct the orchestra for Ben Hur at SUNY Purchase in New York.
Yes,
this must have been in 1990 or 91,
something
like that.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly powerful. It was
90, I think it was, because because I we did we the first thing we did in Purchase was City Lights, and that was only created in 89. So I think it was either that summer or the summer after. And then after we did the Chapin thing. And then I went back and did a sort of double bill, but not, I mean, alternating performances of Greed and Ben-Hur in Purchase. And that was kind of its last gasp because PepsiCo had withdrawn, withdrew its funding. And so that was all over, the 10-year mega and hugely ambitious and costly festival.
I have two memories, two odd memories of that that day. One, that some man had approached Kevin before the screening and said that his had been the hand, the insert of the hand, and, that opened the
brick.
The brick,
fed,
yes.
The fed, lepers.
Yes.
The lepers, yes.
And
mother and the daughter.
That insert of the hand got a big applause when the...
I was there when that happened. I loved that. I thought that was so charming. And he was introduced at a lecture before, and this was the hand. And he had been an assistant on the film.
Yes.
And then, of course, that night when we got to that point, which was meant to be very poignant and, you know, odd, you know, it sort of stopped the show, you know, and the guy was very thrilled.
Yes.
But in the early days when we were doing it in the 80s, of course, there were available to us situations like that, and people did turn up
who
had been in it. For instance, for Napoleon, we the actor who played Roger de Lille in the Marseillaise sequence was alive. Annabella was still alive. Came to a number of performances. And there were the odd people. In fact, quite moving, when we did it finally in Paris in 83, there was a sort of procession at the end, or défilé, they would say in French, of people who had worked on the film, and like 60 people got up and sort of took a bow, you know, and walked across the stage.
Amazing.
You know, and it was, I was watching from the wings, and it as a project, it really meant a lot to people.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking of that day in SUNY Purchase. At intermission, Kevin saw me out in the lobby, and he said, "Do you have to leave right after this?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, come with me after the show because I want to show you something." And we went to a classroom, and as I recall, you were there. It was Walter Kerr was there, Paul Killiam, David Gill, me and my wife, And I think that's all. And Kevin had a reel of hard luck. He had the Buster Keaton's hard luck, of which the ending had always been thought to be lost. None of us in the room had ever seen it. And Kevin just with kind of a flourish said, I just wanted to show you something. And he plays the short, and the ending was there. And all of us in the room were dumbfounded and flabbergasted. And so that was quite a day. That was because Ben-Hur was remarkable, and your score was wonderful and rousing. And I thought you were playing that entire chariot race at Triple F, I think. It was really, really pounding away. Yeah. It was great.
We recorded it at that. I suppose you heard it with a recording.
I'd never heard a recording. No.
Yeah. Well, we made a video for MJ. In fact, today, if you're ambitious, they released the 1960 Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston.
Yes.
But they include a extra DVD, which is our version, in the package.
Nice.
So you could get the 1925 version with your chariot race.
Well, it was quite something.
Though the discovery element played a great part, and sometimes the music actually gives you the clues, because if you get a score which is annotated, like my scores are, at the top of the page, I say, ideally, where I would like to be. And some, there are some scores which were published, and we did a version of an extraordinary film called The Chess Player, the French film. And it had a score by a very good composer called Henri Rabaud, who was a pupil of Fauré. And we were looking at it, and there had been problems about the print. There's always problems about the print. Where do you find the print, and is it that particular print, and so on. And for this opening reel, they had two versions of it, you see. And so they played one. We played one, and I was playing along with it, according to this. And I said, well, wait a minute. There's an indication on the score that there's a shot here, a long shot of these conspirators. But it doesn't seem to be on the video, as we were using then. And they said, well, wait a minute, we've got another version of this reel. So we put that on, and it was there. So we knew we had, in that cut, we had more of the film. And that's where the actual score proved a guide to a restoration. And this is not the first time that happened. I was at one point asked if I could look at the film Metropolis. This was also when it was all beginning. And now we know kind of more has been found and so on. And flew to Berlin, and there was this piano score, with quite a lot of yellow markings and stuff like that. And it turned out that these yellow marks were scenes that had been cut. And they always dealt with the low life, you see, the fun bits, you see, at the beginning of this sort of ideal universe. Down at the bottom of the pyramid was a Chinese bar. Those were the sequences that were missing. But because there had been a score printed of its original cut, they were able to base the restoration on the score. I mean, it told them a lot about what scenes they had to look for and where they came and how long they were and so on. So it's quite interesting that there's a reverse effect it really is kind of detective work.
Yes, it's fascinating. I have done some study of silent film music, of course, and it's almost never the case that anybody wrote an entire score for a film. It's almost always partly composed, partly adapted of other
mostly
tunes.
I suppose, but in Europe there were more. And the two Rabeau scores that exist are very good. There's a Shostakovich score for a film called New Babylon, which is entirely his. And, of course, I do,
yes,
if I can. But not always, because sometimes you actually want someone else's music, you know, as a kind of mirror to it.
Well, in a case like Napoleon, you could hardly avoid it.
That was a necessity because I had 3.5 months to put together 5 hours without any idea of how one did something like that at all. I mean, I knew how to do clips for films, but the situation in August 1980 was, you know, 5 hours. How are we going to do it? And then remembering the interviews I had done for the Hollywood series, that, you know, Anne Leaf opened a cupboard for me. And I said to Anne Leaf, "How do you put together a score for one of these?" And she said, "Well, here's my library," and opened a cupboard. And she said, "That's good for this, and this is good for Chase, and this is good for love stories, and this is good for, you know," and on, that it really was a question of mood music. Of course, my job in writing it or collating it for something like that is to make sure that, you know, the choice that I make is apt, is the right music,
sure,
for it, you know, helps the film rather than tears it down. So in Napoleon, for instance, it became almost the story of the film. You could actually listen to the score and feel you would come out of it knowing a great deal about late 18th and early 19th century music.
Well, that's what I meant. It's, even if you had unlimited time to prepare a score, it's unlikely that you would have avoided the Marseillaise.
There's a sub-documentary aspect to it, in which, particularly because the songs of the revolution do exist, and sometimes in the film the actual tune is slapped on the screen when in the armies. Say, have we your permission to sing? And it's quite clear that they're going to sing "Marbre s'en va ton guerre," or "For he's a jolly good fellow" in English. And a chunk of it is a chunk of the score is on the screen. You know, so you have to do it. You know, but that was fun to it. And we do include the most popular revolutionary songs, as well as the Marseillaise, the Chant du Départ, the Marbre, the Le Carmagnol was a very important one. Ça ira was another important one, and they're all there in the score because that's when they were created.
Sure.
The Brits only have Rule Britannia.
Yes.
A bit.
Well, as horrified as you looked when I told you that I wanted to talk to you for an hour, the hour
We've
is
done
up.
It. So, well, one could go on 4 hours.
Oh,
obviously, there's so much to say on the subject.
Believe me, I only got to about the first three notes of two pages of notes to things that I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Maybe someday we'll talk again.
We'll go on. We'll have an annual. Perhaps. Is this your part of the world? I mean, do you live around here?
Live in Los Angeles.
You live in Los Angeles. Yeah. So you came up. So have you been to the Napoleon yet?
No. We're seeing it tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. Better be
this
good.
This is very, very big in my life.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this very much.
I hope you're not disappointed.
I have a feeling I'm not going to be disappointed. Thank you, Mr. Davis. I appreciate this very
not
much.
At all.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Carl Davis. I got a real kick out of it, and I've admired him for a very, very long time, and was glad to finally meet him after all this time, and had a lot more to talk with him about. I wish we'd had more time, and I hope that our paths will cross again one of these days. They say they're going to show Napoleon again in London in 2013, and by George, I believe I'm going to have to try to make that transatlantic trip this time, because seeing that film with that orchestra and the triptych and all that it came with in Oakland last March, that was just a spectacular experience. And something that I would love to try to recreate. Maybe even go into London would be fun in and of itself. But, man, if you add seeing Napoleon to it, how can you beat it? I hope you will go to thecommentarytrack.com and look for books and videos for sale. There's a page of my books, a page of my videos, and you can, if they just have a price on them, you can order them directly from me, and I'll autograph them for you if you so desire. And if there is no price, there will be an Amazon link. So you can click through to Amazon and buy it, and I'll get a little piece back from Amazon, and that is the way we will keep a little bit of income rolling in, or rather trickling in, because, believe me, not much is coming in at this point. But we're a young podcast and growing, and soon it'll be a deluge of pennies coming back from Amazon. I have nothing but faith that that will be the case. All of Carl Davis's, well, not nearly all of Carl Davis's work is on his page. So when you go to the page, if you want to listen or download the podcast directly from the site, you'll see a little sign that says view full details. I think that's what it says. It's view full something. And you click on that, you'll see whatever I've written for about Carl Davis, and then you'll see Amazon links to films for which he's provided musical scores and for CDs of his music. And it's a really wide range of music, not only material that deals with silent films, but all sorts of good stuff. And you really can't go wrong. And if you haven't heard Liverpool Oratorio, I hope that little 30 seconds I played for you will whet your appetite for that, because it's really, really something special. So I hope you will go to the website. And I also hope you'll go to iTunes, look up the commentary track on iTunes, and give it a high rating, 5 stars. You can give it 6 stars if you can get it to accept it. And if you have something nice to say about the podcast, I hope you'll write it there. All the good reviews and the high ratings help position this in a more visible place, and consequently it will introduce it to more people, and more people is what I crave right now. I really want is to build a bigger and bigger audience for this, and I'm going to do my part by having a continuing stream of fascinating people to talk with, and I hope that you'll stick with us. Next week, we're going to have a lot of fun, because I went to visit my friend Randy Skredvet, and I believe a lot of you know Randy's work. Primarily, I've always thought of him as one of the world's leading authorities on Laurel and Hardy, but he is also a real expert on music of the 20s and 30s and 40s, and for years has had a radio show called Forward into the Past. Fireside Theater, anyone? I think so. Forward into the Past, and he plays wonderful music and sometimes radio shows, and sometimes interviews people who worked on radio, and it's a really fun thing. So I stayed at Randy's a long time, and we talked about many things in addition to Laurel and Hardy, and I hope that you will join us for what I found to be a most enjoyable afternoon of talking movies. So I'll see you next week on the commentary track, and don't worry, we're going to fix it in post.